like that I'm with, then it doesn't exist anymore. Move into building relationships with people of a great diversity of backgrounds. University of Manchester, theology, and I went to Uganda for a year, and just changed my life. From Uganda, I went to theological college. Coming back into British culture, having been in 1985, which was a big year in the history of Uganda, as well as the Ugandan friend with us tonight. 1985 was the year of two presidents. And then 1986, they got the one that they got now. So the Civil War. Well, you know, how would I have known what that was like until I was there? So the culture shock of reverse is huge. And then I went to theological college, I went to Leeds, and then I was living in a multicultural area there, and then went to Tanzania, six years in Tanzania teaching at theological college. Came back, and I've been a missionary in Tanzania teaching at theological college, and I don't know Christians. How can you be a missionary and then you're a Christian? Well, the local church, or it's a church or something, and they're Christians, that's who I know, it's Christians, all the time. So I came back to the evangelism and went to a parish in Mowbray, where I was a team vicar. It was a bit of an arduous task, there was some major issues. And then from there, there was a advert in the Church Times, and it says we want a facilitator for the listening process on human sexuality in the Anglican Communion. Yeah, that's an interesting one, isn't it? What did they want to do? They didn't know. They had no idea. What does that mean? They had no idea. So I walked in day one thinking, what is it I'm supposed to do? And they said, it's like, what is it supposed to do? Work that out. So the engagement with relations became lesbian people across the Anglican Communion, but not the listening myself. We made that an evangelism officer for a diocese, and all the churches go back, oh, good, someone's doing that. But actually, it doesn't work unless you're all involved. So, how do I resource the bishops? Because at 1998 London Conference, the bishops promised to listen to the experience of homosexual persons. Every one of them who voted for the London Conference resolution on homosexuality had voted to listen. They voted to say that marriage was the only place for sexual contact, and the marriage was between a man and a woman. And they voted to say that they wanted to listen to homosexual place. So I was there to help. After a while, I kind of come to the end of that. But as one said, the Lambeth Conference talked about Uganda. And we'll go on from that, and we'll talk about that in a moment, and we'll see where we get to. But I'm here tonight to talk about what is the future for the Anglican Communion. So you may think that there is no future. It's going to fall to pieces. Because that's what you've heard written in the newspapers. That's what you see on the television. I want to tell you. But what you see written in newspapers and see on the television is driven by what sells newspapers and what keeps your interest in affairs correspondence in a job. I have to like BBC British affairs correspondence. It's fantastic. I love it. I really like it. I won't tell you about the ones I get, but I have got a rule. If you ever put me up on the internet, what my rule is that when I read something about somebody on the internet, I just think it might be true. Everything I read about me on the internet, that's his. So why should I believe it when it's written about other people? So that's that. I worked for the Anglican Communion. The Anglican Communion Office is an office of 20 people. Coordinating the Anglican Communion worldwide. There are 70, 60, 70, sometimes 80, depending on whose place you read, members of the Anglican Communion. And there are 20 of us,
sitting in an office in West London, except we're not often there. I was there on my own on the middle floor this week. The evangelism and church growth, the mission power of evangelism and church growth conference. My friend Kerry was in America, and we've just lost our friend Rana. He's gone off to do another job, and so I sat there on my own. That's because they're all around the world and they're busy doing things. So our office is often not very full. And then suddenly everyone comes together and they think, oh, where did we all come from? The Anglican Communion is in 165 countries. There are Anglican churches in 165 countries around the world. So it is quite a remarkable thing. But I'm not really, But tonight I'm going to talk about bananas. Actually, I want to begin with religion in the public space. So Elaine came and talked 2 weeks ago. And she talked about this notion of religion being in the public space. She talked about how significant that idea. I just realised that our printer broke, which is why I'm in such a fluster, because I've got 40-odd pages of this stuff, and the printer broke. And I've just realised I only printed out half of the first page. So I'm now going to have to remember what I wrote here. And then Graham talks about being a post-secular society. Do you remember that? So what she said was, people say that we're a secular society, religion said. But actually, in our present world, we keep coming back to that religion. It keeps being stubborn, it refuses to go. And that's not only Christianity now, it's not only Anglicanism and Catholicism and what have you. There is Islam, there's Sikhism, there's Hinduism, and this public space is there. And that there are some people who want to withdraw into a private space. And they want to set up the rights so that they can defend the rights to wear crosses and so on and so forth. And she argued actually for a new apologetics. That means to step into that space and speak into it with concern for the place, not the church. And that's why I'm talking for now. So what do you notice about these bananas? They're fair trade. So, fair trade. This is an example of where we got to in religion in the public space. 1980s, fair trade was basically coffee. It was basically undrinkable. And basically was only ever served in churches. Do you remember it? And it really was painful stuff. I mean, it really was. It was going to put you off for life. I think the only value in it was that it gave you that idea that you were suffering in the cause of Christ. But no, fair trade, you get these luxurious chocolates, Chilean wines, bananas. Fair trade bananas, often sourced in Caribbean islands, Central American countries, are populated by people who are there because of the slave trade. One of the great things about Anglicanism, its place in the public space, is that some Anglicans, most Anglicans opposed them, but some Anglicans fought to end the slave trade. It's not new for Anglicans to inhabit that public space. Some of our great heroes have done that. People like Desmond Tutu. People like Giovanni Llewellyn. Do you know Giovanni Llewellyn? Okay. Go down to Westminster Abbey. Have a look at the saints on the front of the building. And among them is Giovanni Llewellyn. Archbishop of Uganda, who in the 1970s stood outside the prison that Idi Amin put people in to hear the cries of those being tortured. He walked up and down outside that prison to stand for justice and goodness. isn't it?
Mark. There he is. One of those people who stands in that public space seeking not the good of the church, but the good of the city, that place. Just as we're talking about.
So we are actually carrying on. If I'm pressing bananas, we're just carrying on that work that began with Wilberforce and the like in transforming the realities of people living in the Caribbean. Slavery ended, the people were free, whoopee, but they were very, very poor. And that poverty in itself became slavery, remained slavery. The theological imperative to justice works out in the public sphere, means that 1/4 of bananas now traded.
There we go.
Are we going to do this all the time? Yeah, well, I need to keep changing it over and then it will stop. That's fine. 1/4 of those who are traded are fair trade. It's okay, I'll keep things moving. It's okay.
This is a little bit
busy. Oh, is it? Or has it gone to sleep? I think it went to sleep. Because it went to sleep on the screen. So. Now, I hope none of us are really happy that 1/4 of others are fair trade. Because it means 3/4 are not. But this is not the subject of tonight. Maybe next year it would be trade justice, but that's not what we're doing. We're talking about something else. But what I want you to notice is the way that Christian theology has transformed itself into national protest. So you start with force and drop the debt. And the Jubilee 2000 coalition, fair trade, going into make poverty history, IF is the latest incarnation of that, and it's all behind this Red Nose Day, all this kind of stuff. So we begin with the Christian playing its place in the public space and becoming mainstream. Of course, we want it to. We want it to. We don't want the fair trade section in Sainsbury's being just for Christians. Halal section. In some Sainsbury's there is a halal meat section. Where you go from there. Kosher section? Yeah. Just the Jews. That's not the point for us. Because the point is, if everybody was to buy fair trade, that would break the structure. So we get into that public space and we change it. Is that the gospel? Well, listen to Jesus. In Luke 4. So Jesus in Luke 4 talks about what? Good news for the poor, release of the captives and the oppressed, bringing the year of the Lord's favour. That's his central task. Drop the debt, end the oppression. So, the next question is that the church? Is that the church? If that's the place of the public sphere that Elaine was talking about, is that the church? Or is that the church? If you went out on the streets and on a Saturday and you had the two pictures and you say, spot the church, you get 100% putting a tick by this one. And they'd be thinking you're pretty stupid. Am I right? There you go. That's the question we come up against. Is that the church? Well, there's an interesting debate. Identity versus relevance. Little bit of technical words, but I think we'll get these. Identity versus relevance. Now, as a missiologist, long word, that means I'm a theologian of mission. If you want to know what that really is, I've got an academic article on it that I need to publish at some point. But I think this is the most important missiological dilemma for the church. Identity and relevance. In 1972, a remarkable German theologian called Jürgen Moltmann published a book called The Crucified Christ. And he's often thought of as a systematic theologian. But he's not really. He's a missiologist. And he said that the more theology and the church attempt to become relevant to the problems of the present day, the more deeply they're drawn into the crisis of their own Christian identity. The more theology and the church attempt to become relevant. So when you become relevant, what is your identity? What is it? What makes you Christian anymore? But the other side of that is, the more they attempt to assert their identity in traditional dogmas, rites, moral notions, the more irrelevant and unbelievable they become. Irrelevant. Unbelievable. Women bishops debate. I put up that quote from Jürgen Moltmann the night of the women bishops debate went through. And I heard I got a response, I have to say, on my Facebook friends. Irrelevant, unbelievable. So when the vote came through, the next day in Parliament, David Cameron speaks for the nation. And for once, Ed Miliband's not jumping up to tell him he's wrong. Nick Clegg is by his side. The Church of England is to, do you remember that quote? Get with the programme. It's unbelievable, unbelievable, says David Cameron, that the Church of England in this generation does not have women bishops. I mean, how's the Parliament? It's hardly anything to crow. I mean, they're not a 50-50. Do you know what I have to say? I'll just turn this off, but this is an aside. But you know, the MPs, the Church Commissioner MP, was really having a gap at the church for not appointing women bishops. Was wearing a tie. Do you know what that tie was? It was the Garrick Club tie. Do you know how many women the Garrick Club had in? None at all. He said he was coming up, we'll go at the Church of England while wearing a Garrick Club tie. But the Garrick Club is unbelievable. It is unbelievable that he would do that. It's unbelievable that there are old clubs in Scotland that won't have women on the membership. How could they do that? How could the church do that? The church is what? The church is the Church of England. The word has a claim here. It's the church for the English people. So if you do something certainly against what the English people want to do, what makes you the Church of England anymore? So, this is the church. Vibrant. That's outside. I think I was just trying to work out what that is. I think that's outside New College in Scotland. A place of Calvinist identity. That's the church. But still, we've got our problem. That's the church. Which one? Which one is the church? St. Paul's or the Occupy movement? And they didn't have to get themselves into a mess trying to work that out. You watched it, you kind of like a car crash, wasn't it? Going slow. As the clergy of St. Paul's Cathedral tried to work out whether they were for or against, or ambivalent or welcoming, whether they wanted these people removed, whether they wanted them to stay, whether they could go inside. That question of relevance asks this question. What would Jesus say? To reduce the church to social action, to buying fair trade, is to empty it of identity. To make it a chameleon, Moltmann said. To make it blow on the winds of any particular thing that's going on in the society. You just become just a reflection of that society. You are nothing. To give yourself just identity brings you within walls which you can't escape from, makes you irrelevant to the world outside. This is not a new problem. The Bishop of New York, there's a new Bishop of New York, Anglican Episcopal Bishop of New York, Andy Deitch, preached his sermon, and he said this: the world never runs out of reasons to need the church to be in the world. But if anything I want to tell you today, it's this: the world needs the church to be the church. Politicians love the church when it supports them, hates it when it opposes them. When they're needed for the big society, suddenly the church is wonderful. Big society. You can run all the social work, which we can't do. We campaign against poverty at the Labour Party levels. We run schools across the world. We run more health care than virtually anybody else in Africa. It's virtually run by the church. We need to be relevant to have that identity. But this dilemma is not new. You know, I'm going to ask Faith to come up in a moment and read something. I'm just giving you a moment's warning. It goes all the way back. You know, William Temple goes back to Wilberforce, Francis Assisi, goes back all the way back. Well, when does it go back? It goes back to Jesus. Faith's just going to read something, and there's a microphone here.
So our reading is from Philippians chapter 2, verses 6 to 11. Who being in the very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on the cross. Therefore God exalted him in the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee shall bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, the glory of God the Father.
Identity. God. Lord. Relevance. Servant. Human. Death. Just look at that for a moment and just think about relevance and identity in the crucified Christ. I think I well up with tears every time I hear when I survey the wondrous cross. And of course, the great hymns of the church, many of them are, you know, it's a struggle sometimes to find really good hymns for some of the festivals, but you can have a 3-hour service and you haven't used all the good ones about the cross on a Good Friday. Am I right, Vaughan? You know, you kind of feel, which one am I going to leave out this year? It's easier than Christmas. And of course, everyone likes Christmas carols, but actually, the Friday hymns are just wonderful. And so you look at that and you see that you know, love and power mingled. God on the cross. Just take another look at it, and what you see on there What you see on there is a white man. Yeah? But Jesus was unlikely to have been white. It's a European version. So when you see this, relevance and identity, well, we know Jesus was not a black African, but then he wasn't a white European either. Relevance and identity. This sculpture was made by a man in Brazil who, during the oppressions of the 1970s, was tortured. And it is his own torture represented on the cross. It's a self-portrait in Jesus on the cross. Relevance and identity. Jesus is the Lord of all, whatever race. Is he not Lord also of male and female? If female is not on the cross, why not? It's an offence to many, of course. But then we turn him into a white European, why not into a woman? Because the pictures we have of Jesus on the cross are just representations. They're not meant to be portraits of the person. They reflect our identity. Different to the African, this is an African American in the place of industry, the city. So the person of Jesus on the cross, humbled, nothing, is offensive. It is offensive. How can God die like this? It's an offense to the Jews and foolishness to the Greeks, said Jesus. But it brings us straight into that relevance identity, but it's actually now we've got a complexity, because it's not just our identity. How do we work with the different identities? How can we be one church? What global future does a church have when it's multiple identities? Much easier when it was all one culture. Now it's multiple cultures. How are we going to cope with that? Well, it goes back to Pentecost. I wrote a Pentecost reflection last year for the Continuing Indaba blog. And in that blog, I suddenly realised, when I was reading the Pentecost readings, they're so familiar, I suddenly realised the distinct difference. You put the emphasis is given on the gift of tongues to those who are preaching, yeah? So they preached, but actually the hearers heard in their own voice. God could have given them the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You stick a baby fish in your ear, and suddenly you solve all the problem of a science fiction program where everyone replies, Doctor Who, everybody speaks English, don't they? On Doctor Who, it's very convenient. Wherever they are in the universe, they speak English. Here was the gift of everyone hearing in their own voice, and your own voice. I mean, I speak two languages, speak English and I speak Kiswahili. And Kiswahili, what I've learned is I have to think in a different way. Somebody says to me, how do I say please? You don't want to say that. Somebody came up to me and said, they're sorry for me travelling here. Are they upset? No, they're saying Pole. Pole? You said Pole in Uganda? They say Pole, you can't, because it means I'm respectful that you've made the effort. And the only word I've got in English to say is sorry. Sorry that you came. Well, that doesn't work. Because it's a different thought process. It's a whole different way of thinking. And so the Gospels preach in different thought processes. Right from the beginning, day one, Pentecost. So, the challenge of multicultural Britain, and I kind of get the feeling that that was a challenge here, that sense of what does it mean to be in a multicultural Britain, is right there at the heart of the gospel. The good news needs to be heard in different voices. So the public space that Professor Graham talked about is one where there is a mixture of voices and many cultures. I don't know, how did you feel? I wasn't here when that building went up. Yeah? Okay. How did you feel? Did you feel challenged? Invaded? Enhanced? And by the way, which building am I talking about? Which one do you prefer? Is the Sainsbury's building a particularly nice building that you want to say, I rejoice that there is a beautiful Sainsbury's building on the edge of Leamington Spa, not far from Warwick? Are you going, wow, what a fantastic new Morrison's when I drive into the, towards, you know, this is an architectural... Well... What about the rather glorious one at the back? What an invasion. A lot of people would have thought that. It's a false picture. So there you go. When that went up, what did people think? It's only just over 100 years ago. It's the Guild of Scots Church. You go recognise it? Yeah? It's St Mark's in Leamington. I wonder if you recognise these. Anybody recognise that one? Gilbert Scott Church? Any ideas? It's been in the news in the last couple of years. Christchurch Cathedral in New Zealand. What did the Maori think? Invasion? Challenge? Christchurch Cathedral. Yes. Go on, give a continent. Another Gilbert Scott building. Give me a guess of the continent. India. More precise? Can you get more precise? You? Sorry? It's actually in Bombay. It's not actually a church. I'm a bit of a sneaky one, that one. But it's a Gilbert Scott church in Bombay. My son has been to this one, and I asked him where it was, and he said, I don't know. He guessed Manchester. Gilbert Scott. Any ideas? Continent?
Australia?
Could be Australia, couldn't it? Africa. That's in Grahamstown, South Africa. It could be anywhere, couldn't it? Okay. That's where it is. Any guesses now? Hong Kong, Kowloon. That's... So another kind of Victorian red brick building, imposed in all these alien places. Accra in Ghana. This is a famous one. Tony Blair was, he spoke in there. It was after 9/11. Trinity Wall Street. Trinity Wall Street is one of the richest churches in the whole of the world because Queen Anne gave a bit of land in a place called Manhattan to the church. Well, it's not very much. I mean, it's only a square mile on Manhattan, and it's only got some buildings next to Wall Street. I mean, and they rent it out. You know, what else are you going to do with it? Their property department is three floors of one of those buildings. No, actually, I think it might be seven floors of one of those buildings, their property department. There you go. These buildings. So what is Anglicanism but an expression of Englishness and identity in these parts of the world? And now you're beginning to see a bit of a crisis occurring.
I'm going to go back.
You've got a bit of a crisis occur. If you see that the gospel is that relevance to the place where you are, and you're stuck in a building that might be relevant to Victorian England, how are you going to get over that? What are you going to do to grasp this local?
sign that you're going to make a local decision about the way of Jesus Christ in this place. What happens if somebody else goes off in the opposite direction? How do you handle what is relevant and retain some sense of identity? And this is a major problem for the Anglican Communion, and I've had an awful lot of time to get around to the future for the Anglican Communion. Are we getting
in the 1950s, a couple of people, one from America and one from England, started to ask those questions.
So in the 1950s, one of them was Max Warren.
Max Warren was a leader of the evangelical movement, the head of CMS, based in London. He travelled around the world, particularly in Africa. And he started to see that the whole, you know, wind of change was happening. I mean, you know, that was... He was saying this before that kind of great speech from Macmillan. And he started to say, we've got to move to from domination and coercion, we're going to move to partnership. And actually, it is only the whole world that knows the whole truth. It is only in that encounter with the other that you discover the greatness of God. A single culture cannot know that. It's not possible. Because God is bigger than them. That is an immense discovery. We are not there to teach Africans and Asians about the gospel. We're there to learn with them.
It was really interesting, I was with the White Archbishop in New Zealand. So there are three archbishops, three primates, I don't just have one archbishop in Canterbury. Three primates in Aotearoa, which is the Maori name for the land, New Zealand, which is some foreign name for the land, and Polynesia, because they also have Polynesia there, some of the islands around. So they have an archbishop each, a Maori, a Papua. A Papua is those who are not Maori, and a Polynesian. And they said three archbishops. And I was with the Papua archbishop, and his wife is Maori. He speaks Maori, and he was telling the story that one of the Maori was converted quite early on and learned to read, and she spread the gospel among the Maori. So when the white missionaries moved quite slowly across New Zealand, they came to preach the gospel and found other people there already reading Luke's gospel. They'd already got it. They arrived to find the gospel and to discover it. That's what Max Warren was talking about. Stephen Bain said.
Stephen Bain was an American high church bishop, and he was appointed by Michael Ramsay to be an executive officer for this emerging Anglican Communion thing, which the Church of England suddenly found that it was part of without ever wanting to be part of. Church of England never made a decision to be part of this thing, but it was kind of growing. Some of it was down to CMS and USCA and SPG, and which became USPG and is now called PALS. But some of it was down to non-Americans who kept spreading this thing. So they set up churches in Japan, Mexico, the Philippines, Brazil, and they were all kind of becoming churches as well. And how do we cope with all this? What do we make of this all one? And Stephen Bain says, we've got a problem here. We can't have an Anglican confession. If we have an Anglican confession, what is that? You don't write a confession of faith. You're going to write it down to define what Anglicanism is, but what the faith is. Why hasn't the Methodist so agreed? Why hasn't the Lutheran so agreed? What is the point of that? It's going to be a statement of the faith.
Okay, we can have a compare book.
People keep revising it. They keep changing where it can go. If it's going to be made locally relevant, it's easy to speak, but he's translating it into different languages. And as they translate it into different languages, it means different things. And when they come to have round services, they
really, really go to town about doing different things.
Can you have lots of people receiving communion in church?
Probably not in most cases, for most churches.
Marrying divorced people, remarrying divorced people?
Goodness me, no. Not in most of the provinces, they only begin.
So, how do we get round this?
Well, he said there is that English quickness has to escape from cultural confessionalism, has to start to work out how it can be something else. He came up with a phrase called mutual responsibility and interdependence. I said that wasn't really one word. Mutual responsibility and interdependence. Macmillan used interdependence as the relationship between the new states that were previously in the British Empire. Mutual responsibility, that was the partnership words that Max Warren was using. But it's a struggle, and we certainly didn't get it right. It took a few years ago, another theologian started talking about the Ephesian moment. And again, they said, actually, we didn't look to the Bible, because it's not a new problem. In Ephesus, the church was getting fed up.
You got to the point where it had kids' church and kids' on church. Couldn't meet this and that, wouldn't be circumcised.
They come to the point where they just said, we can't be the same church. We've got three options here. One option, we're going to divide. We'll have a Jewish church and a Gentile church. Option two, we all become Jews. Option three, we stop the Jews being Jews and they have to become Gentiles.
Paul says no.
No. That is not an option.
If Christ is Lord of all, the church is one. If Christ is Lord of all, the church is diverse. Many members of that body. That's there in Ephesians. We've got to live with that. So this is the challenge facing global Anglicanism. How do you get to the point where you can respect that diversity and remain one?
Well, we've tried a number of ways. Some people have suggested we should have a new confession. I've got it in the air, I'm not sure where I was. Do you know there are 900 languages in Papua New Guinea? How can you have one of any if you've got 900 languages?
So, are we going to have a new confession? Are we going to be guided by a set of rules? So if we could all have the same ecclesiastical law, that would help, wouldn't it?
Goodness me, no.
Every Anglican province comes and says, do you know, we're unique. And I go, oh, yes, you're not unique in the, you know, 38 provinces of the Anglican Communion, every single one's got a different constitution. Calls their primate a different thing, has them do different things. They have different ways of electing bishops. Every single one of them is different about everything that you could possibly fathom. It's ultimately conference. So the last round of conference,
people started saying, actually Rowan Williams was on a commission about homosexuality, and at the end of it they said, please, can we have a round of conference?
This was George Carey commissioned this. It was about 2002, I think, 2003. No, probably about 2002. It said, please can we make sure we have a London conference without any reservations? Because they passed resolutions at London conference of bishops. And they didn't take any notice. Because if they passed a resolution on, let's think about something, if they passed a resolution on, baptism right for the whole of the Anglican community, does it have any effect on the Church of England? Well, it's got to go through negotiation after negotiation after negotiation through the synodical process before it can be. By the time you've got round to that, you've got an Anglican conference, they'll pass a different resolution. So, what is the point? That hardly
be a Global Conference resolution you ever looked at ever again. So what didn't you do if you gather bishops, you don't give them something to vote about? The Church of England bishops were furious and led a delegation saying, I'm still not being called, can you come up there? Not Nick Banks, I have to say. That's Bishop of Bradford there. Bishop of Harare. I'm not sure who the two with their backstories are. I think Conrad, I'm not sure. And most of the women were bishops' wives. We have a few, few from America and Canada, one from Australia, who were women bishops, but not very many. There are two in South Africa now, which is great. But they came and they said, actually, we're going to talk with one another about what it was like to be Christian. What is our journey? We're going to study the scriptures together. We're going to walk together. And from that, we kind of said, well, let's give bishops. But bishops kind of live in this model. They can get on and do what they want. What about lay people? What about ordained people? And so, over the last few years, we've been actually engaging people to say, get on a journey, walk. We found some money so we could actually physically move some people. And we got them to go to places that they would never imagine going in any other way. People from Hong Kong going to Jamaica. People from South Africa and from Kenya going, they're in Ghana. They're in Ghana, there on the coast there. That's where they've gone to. They're in Limuru in Kenya. People would never have made those journeys. It was a shock for the Ghanaians and the Kenyans when they went to South Africa, because they went down there and they thought it would be a white country. It wasn't. It was a black African country. This guy here, they said, oh, you're white. Well, he said, well, I wasn't under apartheid, I'll tell you that. It's an engaged conversation, really, really, about avoiding bishops. Ghanaians fall in faith. It's against the tradition of the church. The Kenyans, like in Uganda, Sudanese. It is scriptural truth that women must be indigenous to fully. And they're kind of like, it isn't something to compromise about. The Americans go, I think it's a matter of liberation. And there's this three-way struggle going on. An engaged conversation. What does it mean to be a Christian in context? So I ran that project, and it's so exciting. Unbelievably exciting, because you start to see ways in which they all go home and they say, we've discovered a new way of being church. That is about identity, and it's about relevance, because we're reading the scriptures together, we're walking together, we're listening to our community and our society, and we're going to change the way that we behave. It has rewritten the way that the South African diocese is working. It is rewriting the way that the others are working. It's even rewriting the way the primates are thinking. So the primates gathered in Dublin in 2011. So this isn't just bishops, this is big bishops. So you've got the Archbishop of the West Indies, the Bishop of, the Archbishop of, so you've got the Archbishop of the West Indies, the Archbishop of Burundi, the Primus of Scotland, the host, which was the Archbishop of Armagh, and then I think you probably recognise the former Archbishop of Canterbury. They said this:
in our common life in Christ, we're passionately committed to journeying together in honest conversation. In faith, hope, and love, we seek to build our communion and further the reign of God. We call continuing each other, we call it fullness, a journey of conversation to build relationships, to energize missions. They're journeying together, honest conversation, to further the reign of God, to build our mission.
The ACC met in Auckland last year, New Zealand. There you go, with some of the faces. Lay people, ordained people, elected from every province. One province forgot to elect anybody. Uganda. But that was because they'd forgotten. There was no boycott. You hear a lot about boycott. When there's no boycott, it's not on the television, it's not in the press, it's not on the radio. They came, they discussed, they got excited. In Durban, they said, they actually stood up and gave a round of applause. I wasn't in the room, I was outside, I didn't know they were doing this. They said, in Durban is the process of honest conversation that seeks to build community, energize mission, and provide a context in which conflict can be resolved. They voted on it unanimously, they stood up and they all clapped and they all went and shook hands with each other. That's what they are, a journey of honest conversation. So what is the alternative? So this mutual, supportive process. Well, the alternative is to be isolated, to be insular, and to be introverted. I kind of sometimes think the Church of England. And I just worry. And so the Church of England has a new world mission policy. And it's a commitment to continuing in Durban, in every parish, in every diocese. And that was passed at General Synod. It's not just Lambeth Conference resolutions that are completely ignored. It's also General Synod. And everyone was fussing about women bishops. But in the July Synod last year, while everybody was fussing about women bishops, the Church of England said, for every parish and every diocese, we're committed to continuing in Durban. Conversations last week in Coventry Cathedral between people who are completely split in litigation in the United States, saying, but actually, even after that, we're in two separate churches. We're praying together in a common journey for the sake of mission. Last week, actually ended this week, this group of women met in New York to talk through what Indaba meant. But actually they started talking about the issues that mattered to them. Violence towards women was particularly high on the agenda. How they could transform their societies and how they could discover from one another the tools to do that. And continuing Indaba is the heart of that. For lay women, ordained women, men, bishops, archbishops. So does the Anglican Communion have a future? Yes. Actually very, very exciting. 2008, I was the only one saying that, and people were laughing at me. But now, it does. It has a future. There are a lot of problems. A lot of people think that this is a giving in to the spirit of the age. No, it's walking with Christ, and the scriptures are at the heart of it. But actually even more at the heart is the relationship